RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Everyone should live a creative life. So says my guest today. She is the author and illustrator Marion Ducharth. Since publishing her first book, Let's Make Some Great Art, in 2011, she has set about evangelizing and demonstrating just how anyone, both children and adults, can unleash their inner artist. In this interview, recorded during lockdown, Marion talks about her Scottish childhood, her love of drawing, and her eventual pathway to her own creative life, culminating in a place at the Royal College of Art in London. I started our conversation by asking Marion about her intriguing and rather beautiful surname, Ducharth.
It reminds me a bit of Thomas Hardy and d'Urberville. You know, it's got that sort of feel to it. So I looked it up because I was interested. I thought, is it Brent? But it's very much a Scottish name.
Very much a Scottish But don't you think it could be linked to the old alliance of France and Scotland?
Because
it doesn't sound very Scottish and doesn't look very Scottish.
Not at all, no.
And in Scotland, they don't say Ducharth either.
Oh, they don't. What do they say?
They say all different things, actually. They go everything from Dukers to Duchers with a ch to Dukers. I mean, it's one of those names people don't really know how to pronounce anywhere. And in the end, it kind of got metamorphosed into Ducharth because it's how it looks. That's how it kind of sounds phonetically, doesn't it? But my family think I'm a bit all hoity-toity.
It was apparently the highest incidence of Ducharth is in America. There's loads there. And also, there's another weird fact I found out, that in 1891, Middlesex had the highest population of Ducharth families.
That's very odd.
I don't know why.
Because actually it comes from Perthshire, which is where my father's from. And there's even a little microbrewery there called Dukers IPA, I think. But it's, as far as I knew, that was the only area that was prevalent in that name. But it was a really unusual name when I was at school. No one had heard of it originally from that area. But we're probably all related somewhere along the line.
Well, being an illustrator, I think, you know, because the kind of audience for RDI Insights is quite broad. So you've got all the design disciplines plus students or anyone interested in design around the world. So it's quite a big family of people that listen into these things. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to start by talking about life as an illustrator, because I'm sure most people, when they think about illustrators, would think of, I don't know, Helen Oxenbury or Judith Kerr, you know, sitting at home at a scrub top kitchen table, painting away, often with a cat wandering around in the background. And I think, you know, maybe people would think of you as that, but I know for the last, 20 odd years, you prefer to work with a bevy of other people in an open shared workspace as opposed to working at home. What I'm kind of interested in is that the tables have been turned now because you've been forced to work at home because of the pandemic. So how have you found that?
It's funny you say that because it was the first time I've actually ever worked from home because straight from college, from the Royal College of Art, I graduated and moved our studio at the Royal College into a commercial studio. We just kind of moved. We didn't really want to leave college. And I think we just kind of took our studio with us. And so I've always worked in a multidisciplinary studio until quite recently, actually. And working from home was a bit of a shock to the system for me, actually, because I always thought I couldn't work from home. But like anyone who's in the creative arts, I think if you get a challenge, if something's different, whether it's travel or something happens to you, it can be quite good for your creativity. So in retrospect, working from home has actually, I think, been a very, very creative time for me, purely because I had to turn it on its head of like thinking I can't work in a domestic setting with too many distractions. I've got dinner to make, I've got the kitchen floor to wash or whatever. And suddenly I had to think of it as a creative space. And I think I really embraced it, to tell you the truth. I actually thought, well, why not turn the home into a space where I can be inspired? And so I think I worked quite hard, especially in the early days of lockdown, to kind of think, well, what can I do here that I don't normally do in my studio? I think when I look back in the last year, I've had a bit of a creative outburst, I would say. And it's partly to do with, it could partly just be to do with change or pause or whatever. like a lot of people have had in this time. I've had time to reflect and have had time to be more creative, perhaps. But I think it was just the novelty, to tell you the truth, of working from home as well. I've strangely found it quite inspiring. I don't know long term how that would pan out, but at the moment I'm still kind of digging into that idea of not having to go somewhere every day and be at work every day.
I was wondering, you know, normally, I mean, designers and illustrators and creatives generally tend to be, they use the right side of their brain. That's the way it works. And so a lively visual and creative environment stimulates artists. They like it, you know. Conversely, writers use the left side of their brain and they like to be tucked away by themselves because they're writing and they don't want any complications. Now, I was thinking suddenly, well, you now write as well with Bob, your little character. And I'm wondering, did you write Bob in that same space, you know, with all that, all those different people and telephones going off?
No, I don't think I would do that. I think actually, ultimately, when I have to write, I have to go to a different space again. I normally go to a cafe or go outside. Or I need a kind of different stimulus. You're right, for writing, it's a different side of the brain. But I kind of need a different kind of distraction. So yeah. I don't really like silence. Yeah, it has to be kind of watching people watching.
Yeah, cafes are great places to write. Anyway, I think virtually everything you look at or engage with is a creative opportunity. I mean,
yes,
in a drawing, but
agree.
It is. You can make it that way. Anyway, I want to drag you back to Scotland now. You were born in the lowlands of Scotland, in Falkirk, Stirlingshire,
yes,
which is, well, what, 20 miles or so from Edinburgh?
It's about 20 miles from Edinburgh and 25 from Glasgow.
Right.
So it's right in the middle, yeah.
And that's where I think the Grangemouth oil refinery is, in the distance.
That's right.
So you probably have...
That's just actually where we live.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, I've passed through there, I mean, many years ago, going up to the Highlands of Scotland.
Mm. People generally pass through it.
Well, but at night it's quite extraordinary. It's sort of beautiful... You know,
it is beautiful. It has its own beauty. I think it was supposedly inspired. The opening scene of Blade Runner.
Yes.
Is inspired by Grangemouth, which is the refinery. Did you know that?
I did know that. I remember hearing Ridley Scott talk about that. And yes, sure enough, it is. Does it have it? It has its own beauty, I think.
Well, the funny thing about that area, because obviously. It's not. I remember I used to kind of pretend I wasn't from there because I was slightly embarrassed, I think. Because it's, you know, it's an industrial town and it's not the prettiest of towns. And when people think of Scotland, they have this romantic idea of where I'm from. And, you know, I probably didn't want to quash that idea. But in the same breath, I used to be able to cycle from that little industrial town to, you know, 5 miles to a medieval wood where, you know, I could dig up Roman coins and I could have my picnic on a medieval gravestone. So the great thing about that part of Scotland is it's so steeped in history, and it's such an amazing area, actually, the central Scotland. And you can kind of get anywhere very quickly. You know, you can 20 minutes and you're in Edinburgh, or 25 minutes you're in Glasgow, or you're in Stirling, you can be at the scene where the Battle of Bannockburn was. So
yes.
Historically, I found it very, very rich as an area. And I remember even as a young kid being very drawn to all of that heritage. And I was really interested in history and really interested in nature, despite growing up in a very little industrial town. So
it now has its own massive sculpture, doesn't it, of the two horses' heads.
I need to tell you a quick story about that, because it's fantastic redevelopment they've done around that area, because it's linked up all these cycleways. And also the area used to be called, I have to say it in Scottish, the Bog, which just is spelled B-O-G, but it's a bog.
Oh,
basically,
yeah.
It was
the
bog. It basically was a marshland, but it was a very rough area. Like, so people from the Bog were a bit tricksy, and you know, they might have knives in their pocket. It was a like really dodgy area. And so we used to kind of pass through the bog very quickly. You know, it's not an area we'd want to hang out in. And now what I think is really amazing is they've done this incredible landscaping, done this beautiful landscaping actually, you know, with wild marshland and walkways and cycleways, and built the kelpies. And they've just regenerated an area that was like a desolate landscape, you know, when I was growing up. So I think that regeneration has just been so inspiring to see it now, to see that whole area.
Let's go back before that happened. So tell me about your childhood and family life. What did your parents do, for example?
My father, who is no longer alive, sadly, was originally an electrical linesman. So he used to put those huge big pylons up in the Highlands. That was his job. And he was married quite young. It's quite a quickly try and condense the story. He was married quite young and had three children quite quickly. And sadly, his wife died from leukemia in the space of a year, and he had like three very young children. And he then moved to around the Falkirk area. And I think the children were kind of in a nunnery at that point, in a convent. And he met my mother, and he, you know, very quickly got together with my mother. And then she was pregnant with me, and she gave birth to me, but then took on my father's three children as well. And then she subsequently had another two children very quickly. So I think by the time she was 25, my mother, she had six children.
My goodness.
Like under the age of 10. So it's kind of quite mad.
So what sort of house did you live in?
Well, we just, we,
children?
Yeah, I know. Well, we didn't have our own rooms, put it that way.
No,
we just,
no.
We lived in a, I think it was a split level house that had three levels. We weren't hugely wealthy. I think my father at that point then started working in Grangemouth, because there was a lot of work there. So he became a fireman in the, I think they call them chemical firemen, because they had to deal with any fires that happened in BP or ICI at the time. So he was working there. My mother didn't work, obviously, because she wouldn't have had time to work. She was too busy washing nappies. But I had a very, you know, I had a classic working class Scottish upbringing. I don't know if you've ever heard of the book Motherwell by Deborah Orr, but I read it recently, and actually it was kind of just my, apart from the relationships, which are very different, it was just really my childhood. She managed to write really brilliantly about growing up in a Scottish working class town, and I realised every single town in Scotland in the 70s was probably very, very similar to what I experienced. I think in retrospect I wasn't a bit more kind of embarrassed about where I came from, but as a kid actually I had a great childhood.
Sure.
And I was saying to my own children recently, when I was probably trying to reprimand them for something to do with money, and I said, look, I grew up where we didn't have much money. And they immediately said back to me, yeah, but you had all that freedom, which is so true, because, you know, I had a slightly feral upbringing where there was so many kids in the streets, and there was so many, you know, I was one of six, you know, and everyone seemed to have lots of children in their family. I wasn't unusual, but we spent a lot of time on our own, like, and we would walk from our house all the way into the countryside, you know, we'd walk along the burn, the little river that ran through Grangemouth, and we'd take the whole day and take a picnic, and we'd be gone for the whole day, and we'd come back at 5 o'clock at night.
I'm much older than you, but I mean it was exactly the same. There was a great freedom, and I think parents allowed their children to
freedom to dream.
Yes.
Because one of my strongest memories is actually going for walks on my own and going to quite desolate places. And I had this favorite little place, which was an old it was in Bourness actually, which is a few miles from my town, and it had an old slag heap, which was, you know, where the pits used to be.
Yes.
But it was so old, the slag heap, that it was actually quite beautiful, and it was full of trees and greenery. And I used to find this little spot, which was with an overhanging edge, and I used to dangle my legs off the edge of it. I mean, it was like a kind of 30-foot drop.
Can you imagine parents doing that now?
And I used to dangle there, and that was my dreaming spot, I used to call it. I used to go to dream by myself as a, you know, 11, 12-year-old girl.
I mean, these
quite
days, social securities would be around me.
I know.
You know, there's no two ways about it. Our respective childhoods, be they, you know, 20 years apart, doesn't matter. There was an incredible freedom. You were just left it. And I think it was, for me, it was mostly because my mother was always, you know, working her socks off. My dad was in a factory, and they just want to get rid of us. You go off and do whatever you want. What I wanted to go on to was, what about the siblings, or your half-siblings? What did you all do? I mean, how did you, were you the only creative one, or is it?
No, I should also mention that there's five girls and one boy. So the youngest was the only boy. And actually, my brother, who's a couple of years younger than me, was very talented at art. And so was my older half-sister, who's the one I probably copied. But to be fair, I think both my parents were actually really creative and just never had that opportunity. But they both used their hands a lot. My dad was someone who could, you know, make anything, fix anything. He was very talented that way. And my mother was actually really good with her hands as well. Her craft skills are really, really high. I think we were kind of encouraged to encouraged to do whatever we wanted to do. There was no pressure because it was not like they didn't have any expectations in a strange way. So it was, if you were good at something, then it was celebrated. And I think coming from a big family, you have to find something you're good at to kind of stand out, to get attention. And so I think if you got any kind of attention from what you did that was good, then you did more of it because you were trying to, you know, squeeze a bit more of that mother's love, which had to be split six ways, you know, had to, yeah, try to carve a bit more of it.
That's tough. Did your creativity show in what, drawing? Was that
your
thing?
I think I used to, I would say that when I was younger, I had two interests. One was I used to do athletics from a young age. Right. My sister and I used to run, and we used to do run competitions every year. We had this in our hometown. It was quite a wealthy socialist town, Grangemouth, because it was subsidised by those big industries. Mm. So we had a huge, we had the first tartan track in the country, I think. It was one of the, you know, the first time it went from asphalt, a running track, into that rubber track. And so we had amazing sports facilities. We had a fantastic swimming pool, a sports complex, and this huge stadium. So, you know, it's on your doorstep. And so I think from the age of nine, we'd joined the athletics club there. I used to run and do long jump when I was in long distance as well. So my two interests were running and drawing, and they were kind of both polar opposites in a way. But in another way, they're quite similar, aren't they? Again, it's this kind of goal-orientated pursuit, so that I could easily find parallels between the two. But my mother used to think it was hilarious that when I wasn't running, like running flat out, killing myself, I was kind of lying flat on my back drawing. You know, I had two, it was like two different sides of my personality. My family used to sometimes call me lazy, actually, because I used to try and avoid all the chores by pretending I was too tired or whatever. Yeah, some of those labels still stick. I sometimes still think I'm a bit lazy because I was given that label when I was younger. Yeah, I was literally running my guts out, you know.
At school, were you particularly academic? I mean, obviously sports.
I was pretty good at academically, but not, I wouldn't say I was top of the class, but I was always kind of, I was really good at English, actually, really good at writing, funnily enough. I think maths I used to struggle a bit with, but in terms of English and history, and I was pretty good, actually.
So when did the seed start to grow creatively?
I think it's pretty young. I was always drawing, and so was my sister, and so was my brother. By the time I got to high school, we had an amazing, I think it must have been, again, it must have been the 80s, wasn't it? No, 70s, sorry, where they put a lot of funding into the arts. And there was a whole top floor of this massive building that was an art department that had four art teachers alongside a photography department and a ceramic department. That was in Grangemouth. And they were very talented teachers. So my particular teacher was a Scottish painter, Mr. McDougall, and he was the only Scottish artist that used to meet Salvador Dali every year. So he'd come back from his holidays from the summer and show us pictures of him and Salvador.
Wow.
And he used to kind of mold himself on him a bit. He had the same moustache.
Really?
I mean, they're all eccentric. They're all mad, my art teachers. The other one actually had a metal plate in his head and used to kind of was a bit crazy. And he used to sometimes play really loud kind of opera on a record player in the room, you know. They were completely barmy and eccentric, but very, very inspiring. So I think once I found that department, they were really encouraging, and they kind of really pushed for me to say, you know, this is where you should go to art school, blah, blah, blah.
So indeed you did do that. You went for a four-year course as a student at the Duncan
of Jordanstone, yes. Dundee, yeah.
School of College of Art and Design in 83. So that was a really transforming time for you, because you would meet other like-minded people, which is always important for anyone creative, I think, you know, to be with others that think like you. And there's a kind of shorthand. How did you find the experience?
It was a great art school, and it still is a great art school, I think. But I think it was particularly good because it had been designed as an art school. So it wasn't like a building that had been transformed into an art school. So there were proper studios there, proper lighting, had been carefully thought about, fantastic print room. And it's a different system to England and the Scottish art schools. You basically do your foundation as part of your degree. So it's a 4-year course, and the first year you do a bit of everything. After the first year, everyone goes off and does their specialism, but they're still your friends. You know, you've met people from sculpture, you've met people doing metalwork, you've met people doing jewelry, whatever, and you go on and you kind of study. You're not in their class, but they've become your friends. And I think that was a really healthy way to kind of run an art school, where it's you're not kind of sectioned off too quickly into your specialism.
Now that was in Dundee, wasn't it? So did that mean, did you live there or did you commute?
Oh no, I lived there. I think it was good to move away from home, because otherwise I would have been, if I'd gone to Edinburgh or Glasgow, I could have just traveled from home. But it was so it's always good to you know, I think I just find myself a room in a flat the first year. There wasn't so many halls of residence then. You just had to kind of turn up and find a flat. And
4 years.
I was there for four years. I think you just, that's when you grow in those 4 years. I was quite green when I went there, quite young.
Yeah, and of course it's the home of DC Thompson, isn't it? The Beano, the famous Beano.
It's a really interesting place, Dundee, actually. I mean, it used to be famous for whaling, and then it was famous for jute. And when I was there, all the big jute factories were still there, but they were empty. I think they've all been converted to luxury flats now. But it's an interesting place. It was very much a great place to be a student, because there wasn't a whole big industry going on at the time. There was a huge research university there, the Nine Wells Hospital as well. It's very big on medicine, very big, a fantastic university as well. Yeah, it was a great student town because you could walk everywhere.
You did very well there and got yourself a BA honours degree, and then you moved on to the Royal College, which is, you know, I mean, that is quite something to move from Scotland down to London. So when did that sort of idea present itself? Did somebody suggest, well, you should apply to the Royal College, or was that your own idea?
I can't remember. I knew I was always going to London after Dundee, actually. Dundee was not somewhere I was planning to stay, you know, after graduating. So I'd always planned to go to London either way. And then I think I applied to the Royal College. I don't think anyone thought I was going to get in, even within my department. And when I got that letter, it was the only master's in the country at the time as well. It was really hard to get into. When I got in, I really felt like I'd just got Willy Wonka's golden ticket. I mean, that's really what it felt like.
I'm sure.
I just thought, this is it. See, this is like the doors have opened, you know, because it was suddenly just felt like coming to London was always going to be daunting. And I did know a few people that had kind of gone there the year before that I'd become friendly with. But the idea of having a college to go to just made that jump much, much easier. Because, you know, you've got your little village there, haven't you? You kind of got your network by going to college there. That would be much, much harder to come to London without that, I think. You could still do it, but it would be so much harder. I was very excited. Yeah,
I'm very interested to know, because I've interviewed other royal designers far older than you, talked about their experience of suddenly arriving at the Royal College. This would be in 1948 or the early 50s. I'd be interested to know how you felt when on that day you arrived there, all these different people from different parts of the country, if not the world. Mm. How was it?
I think I do remember just feeling ecstatic, actually, when I got there. And then I was just so excited at the potential. And then I think Quentin Blake had actually just retired the year I joined. I think the first thing, of course, you notice when you go to Royal College, you suddenly in with a group of people who are all as talented as you are. And it was quite scary. That was the one thing that was quite scary about it. I'd been in the best of my year from Dundee or from school or whatever. And suddenly you're in an environment where everyone around you is very, very talented. And everyone was very, very driven and, you know, very self-sufficient that way. I think I've never worked as hard in my life as I did there. But I was also aware that I should play hard as well, if that makes sense. I remember one of my old tutors from Dundee has said to me, make sure you don't kind of miss out on living life as well as working hard, because you could see I was quite a hard worker. I think that's what we did. I think we worked very, very hard at the Royal College. I made some amazing friends that are still friends with now.
Who were your fellow students there?
It was people like Lawrence Deegan and Jason Ford, Tanya Willis was there. I mean, there's quite a lot of, they were, like you said, they come from all walks of life and from all parts of the country. We were just really eager to kind of find new things and see new things. One of the first people I met was Patrick Thomas, actually, and Chris Draper, and they'd been to St. Martin's, and they were quite cool students in a sense that they were quite a bit more worldly than us hickeys that had come from out of town. And I do remember hanging out with Patrick and Miles Aldrich, who wasn't at the college but was friends with Patrick, and Chris Draper, and we really did go and see really interesting films and exhibitions, and we used to hang out in the Troubadour Cafe, and you know, we were really trying to be proper art students, I think, quite hard to kind of get every kind of almost squeeze everything out that we could get out of life. I think we were doing that. We were just really, eyes were open, ears were listening. We were kind of just hungry for stuff, hungry for culture. For me, it was one big, it was a whole new education. And it just really kind of inspired me to read more, to see more, to learn more. And I think that was one of the great things about the Royal College. And there was no set project. There was no kind of, you didn't have to pass an exam or a module or anything. It was all about really trying to find your own personal voice from then. Yeah. And that's not easy when you're that age, because you don't really have much life experience. So there was a lot of grasping around trying to find something worthy to make art about. And sometimes it just wasn't there because, you know, we just didn't have that experience. But what you could do was just get that input, you know, was learn as much as you can and see as much as you can, experience as much as you can. Try, you know, aim for that, but not necessarily make it.
Well, at the end of all that, you start to illustrate in what has become a, actually historically, a very traditional thing to do. If I look back at various people that went to the Royal College, like David Gentleman, for example, mm-hmm. starting off with book covers, and often mm-hmm. Penguin. And I think you did early on start to illustrate for Penguin and book covers, mm-hmm. and also you taught as well, didn't you?
I had to do a bit of teaching.
Just a little bit.
For financial reasons, I had to do that. But that wasn't a bad thing to do, because it's...
I think you taught Tom Gould, didn't you?
I did. I wouldn't say I taught him.
Well,
I would say...
okay. Stroke
was there.
Him. Stroke.
I was listening. Yeah. I laughed at his work.
Well,
I got it.
It paid off.
I got it.
But you then developed, so you started off with book covers, and I remember them very well, those early book covers of yours, which had a very nice, lovely abstract tension to them. Mm. I always liked them. And then you started to use your own handwriting, mm. and that rapidly appeared, gracing everything from magazine covers to menus to art shop materials to stamps. And you became, you know, the queen of hand-drawn lettering, and the many imitators followed. And I wondered how you felt about that at the time. You know, it was suddenly an explosion of, oh, that's Marion Duchat. That's her very characteristic handwriting.
I think what's interesting about illustration, because it's fashion-led, I would never have predicted that I would have ended up doing more hand lettering than drawing. It was just something that caught the zeitgeist. You know, it just happened, and it happened to be my hand lettering that looked right at that time, in that moment.
I remember you doing the... I think the D&AD annual report.
That was kind of what started it,
which,
I think.
Was
it was
really
with Vince. Yeah.
Our large format suddenly arrived, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. You know, the whole bloody thing is handwritten.
Well, that was with Vince Frost. And
I remember. It was very beautifully done. I mean, and I think I've got a copy actually here in Dorset somewhere, hidden away. That was the thing that suddenly... everyone knew who you were.
I think from that point, I haven't really stopped doing hand lettering. I'm still doing it now, and it's since then, actually. It was about 2000, wasn't it? So, I mean, I love doing hand lettering, and it's lasted this long.
I'm
surprised I'm still doing it. Actually.
It's very interesting, Marion, because Alan Fletcher, who for many years, and I interviewed him not for an RDI Insights, but for a magazine, what I learned about Alan was that while he was at Pentagram for so long, he got... towards the end of his time there, he got absolutely bored with dealing with clients, and he slowly went backwards into simplifying. So he decided everything would be very simple. He'd use scissors, coloured paper, and his own handwriting. No need for typesetting. All of those basic things, which actually we'll go on to a little later about your own work, but he found a sort of peace that he could do everything within his own little world without anybody else collaborating. You know, he didn't have to get a photographer or a typesetter or whatever. He'd do it all himself, and he'd be witty and funny. He was that all his life, of course. But towards the end, he did a massive work. You know, whether he was out in the gutter in where, near where he lived, you know, finding bits of cardboard with nice lettering that he could make a collage with. You know, he'd do it. One of the things he did, which amused me no end, was that his grandson was with him. And he said, I'm not very good with children. So, of course, what he did with children, which is what I always do with children, is I draw. He decided that they'd make animals. So they got lavatory rolls and cardboard.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing
that. And they made these beautiful animals. Now, those animals were supposed to be for his grandchild. But typical Alan, when he'd finished them, he thought, actually, I quite like these. I'm going to keep them. And they ended up being in the Royal Academy summer exhibition. So it was very
in the spirit of Calder, weren't they? That kind of idea of play, you know.
Very much.
It's a wonderful place to be, to make work like that.
Well,
actually,
talking of making work like that, you in 2011, you then went on to publish your first book, which is Let's Make Great Art, mm-hmm. which I have to admit I bought many times for my grandchildren, and they all love it, and that's so good. It's still in print, mm-hmm. and I think it's in many, many languages. And one of the things I was going to ask you is that you've made a rod for your own back, because presumably when they're in a different language, you have to read all the lettering.
I don't actually.
Oh, you don't?
So no, I made about three different fonts of my own hand lettering.
Oh, I see.
Oh no, it would be impossible. I mean, I could easily be doing. Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
I think it would be like capital punishment.
I do the covers sometimes, just so they're in 25 languages. I'd still be doing them now.
You would be. I thought to myself, because you've got what, 10 books in print. I think you've got another one out this week.
I've got a few out there. I've got some little board books out there.
Yes, you have.
This week.
Yeah. I noticed on your Instagram you've been promoting. Animated, which is.
I didn't do that. They're very simple anime. I didn't do
no,
that.
No, but they look very good. They work very well. Let's move on to your life now. You're married to Angus Hyland, who's a Pentagram partner and very well known. So I'm wondering, with two, you know, creatives tend to be pretty obsessional and, you know, focused, and two under one roof. That can be difficult. I just wonder what it was like living with another creative who's got a problem on his mind. It's ever, you know, occupying everything, and you've got a problem on your mind about what Bob going to do next.
You know, the funny thing about Angus and I think we work, because we don't really work together very often, actually, and the way we work is quite different, and we've kind of, you know, Angus has got the proper job in a funny sort of way. I think we complement each other really well. I completely trust him as a judge of my work, and I think he feels the same about me, so that I think we're very good at we're quite honest and brutal with each other when it comes to criticizing each other's work. I think if you have respect for your partner that way, like I respect his opinion very much, and I think he respects mine, then it can work very well. And actually, I don't think we've ever had a problem having two creatives under one roof. If anything, it's been, I feel really lucky to have him. I mean, sometimes I don't want to show him something because I know if he doesn't like it, he's going to tell me. And I know he feels the same. But what's been interesting in lockdown is when I was saying I had a creative output and felt very inspired, I think he did too. He's been painting himself, and I really love his work. He's made that jump into making stuff for himself. And I think we definitely help each other that way. And sometimes I feel it's a bit squeaky clean creative household, you know. Sometimes all four of us, our two sons as well, are all mucking in and making art, but Swiss Family Robinson is a bit kind of, it's like, oh my god, something's happened here where I feel like we've got a creative household sometimes. I mean, I'm not saying all the time, but it's there's definitely some fantastic things that have happened, and I think we inspire each other. But I know that I can equally be inspired by them, that they'll always do something that surprises you. And
well, I mean, kids are great, as long as they haven't got to that point where they become self-conscious.
They've been through that, actually, out the other side. So.
Oh, well, that's good. Because I know from, I mean, I have six children. And two marriages, six children. But anyway, I mean, my eldest family, children, grandchildren. And I've always drawn. For me, drawing is a language. It's one of those wonderful things where it breaks down everything. You don't need to. You can be in a foreign country and draw a picture. Everyone understands. So that's the magical thing about drawing. And I've always been able to diffuse, you know, difficult children with drawing. I'll just say, what would you like me to draw? And I'll draw a tractor or whatever they want. And suddenly they're quiet and they're right in there and they want to draw as well. And of course, they draw totally freely. No perspective. It doesn't matter. What comes out is more often not far better than you can imagine. which I love. And so I just find kids really incredible. It's great fun. We're talking about sort of lives as a illustrated designer working together. And of course, your environments become very important. Designers, all the designers I've known over the many, many years, whenever you visit them, you know, there's a magical quality in a reflection of their personalities in their spaces, you know, whether it's collecting stuff, whether it's paintings, whether it's furniture, whether it's a kind of creative chaos, whatever it is, it's always wonderful. I'm the same. I mean, I do care a lot about things. And I remember way back when I was a humble commercial artist in a little studio washing paintbrushes and all that sort of thing. This is a long time ago, Marion. When I finally got to a design company that I felt was proper, I worked for an American design company in this country, and they had Charles Eames furniture. And I'd never heard of Charles Eames. But for me, that moment was so special because I thought there's a whole new world I know nothing about. Interior design. And, you know, suddenly you become very conscious of furniture and how furniture fits together and how furniture fits within a space and then how paintings are hung. You know, it becomes so your world expands into a whole new thing. So I've always maintained that no matter whether I'm in a big house following divorces, in a small house, it doesn't matter. I can always make a small little space interesting because it's interesting for me, and other people may find it interesting. It doesn't matter. But I think that's the great thing about designers. Designers, illustrators, creators, it doesn't matter. They always create an atmosphere that is rather nice to be in. I've always loved books. I worked in publishing for 10 years, and so I've got thousands of books. And okay, books these days, people say books are dead. Not a bit of it. I like them around me. They're like a comfort blanket.
We've run out of space for books, actually. We've got to that point where Angus has been quite clever and put shelving above doorways and things like that. You know, so we've got to the point where we think if we buy a book, one has to leave. So it's one in, one out at the moment.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Actually, funnily enough, another quite well-known designer said to me, not about book, I don't know about you, but I get really upset if I have to deal with covers, be they book covers or DVD covers, that I don't like. So I decided about 10 years ago, when DVDs were, that's all you started to get, that I'd have a cover styling that I used for all my DVDs. So I would, as they arrive, because I'm a member of BAFTA, and so I get all of the new films every year, lots of films. So all the ones I like, I create new covers in this particular style, right? So I happened to mention this to someone, and they talk about, you know, sort of a put down. They said, oh, you still have DVDs, do you? And I thought, oh, God, I've done all this work, and all I could do now is just stream them. Everything changes so quickly because of digital. And that brings me on to your world, because what I love about your work is that, you know, your children's activity book have such a simplicity of engagement, really, because all you need is colour paper, paints, crayons, glue, scissors, nothing to plug in at all, no power. And if you really were struggling, you could work under candlelight. And that's what I love, because stripping everything away to bare essentials, I think, is actually, it's like all things with design, I think, that when you're limited, the potential is far greater. You can be far more creative if someone says, okay, Marion, we've only got two colours. Sorry about
that's
that.
That's it.
And
those parameters are good. Yeah.
I think so. And I think that's the great thing about what you've been doing with your book, because I know from my own grandchildren, they absolutely adore the challenges that you set out in your books for them, and they in turn are used at school and so forth. So it's a great thing to do. And that brings me to asking you at this point, you know, graduated to book, you're now writing book, got your little character as well. And of course, occasionally, I guess you still carry on with some commercial. But to be able to be the creator and the client, if you like, of your own work must be far more rewarding. I don't mean financially, I mean for yourself as an individual.
I think it's a lot more rewarding. I think I did my stint as a commercial illustrator. And I mean, I enjoyed it when I was doing it. I used to believe that I could turn anything into an image. But there comes a point where you're repeating yourself, or the ideas are repetitive, or the brief bores you. And that's the point when you need to shift. I think the books were a big breakthrough for me, in a sense that becoming my, you know, author of my own work and ideas was very liberating. And actually, it's kind of an endless project now, isn't it? I can kind of take it with me to the grave. As long as I keep coming up with new ideas.
You've got your little bird Bob who can really
I think I should really come up with some new characters too. And also the thing about the books, I know they're for children, is that in the back of my head I still would like to do one for adults, actually. Ooh. Because I kind of sort of working on that in the background all the time, because I think if I have to sum up what I do, sometimes people ask you what your job is, and we started at the beginning of the interview by saying what is an illustrator. And you know, if you're in a taxi and you tell your taxi driver I'm an illustrator, they've got that image of someone hunched over the kitchen table. And I think if someone asks me what do I do, or what do I, how do I want to be known, in a funny sort of way, I think from my heart I'd have to say that I want to make work that inspires everyone, not just inspires everyone in the sense of being inspired, but to inspire them to be creative as well. And that's like my kind of mission statement now. It's like, well, I do really think it's the way to live your life, regardless of where you're from or what you do. I think we all have that space that we can make time for creativity and find something that we can produce with our hands. It's just very, very good for the soul, for one, but it's how we should live. It's what we should be doing.
I totally agree. And sadly, when you go out and walk around, you see people looking at their phones. I walk every day. I see a lot of riders, because a lot of horse riding people here, texting on their horse. And I thought, oh no, this is ridiculous. Now, as they pass by me, I'm up, it's pretty high around here, and I'm looking out to sea where there is a group of cruise ships which have been anchored out to sea for a year, six of them, beautiful, beautiful ships. And there's this person on a horse, higher than me, that can see all this. And what are they doing?
Texting.
And that's why I like the books that you produce, because anything that will take a kid away from a tablet...
It's not just kids, though. I think adults are pretty much. I've got screen limits. I put screen limits on my kids' phone, but I also put it on my own, because it's quite good to know how, you know, you don't know how long you've been on your phone sometimes. And now mine tells me your time's up. I've got this idea that if I make more than I look, I think my balance is okay at the moment. I think I'm still making more than I'm looking at stuff. Then I think that's a good thing, because I always lose when I'm on my, I always call it my play desk, is a desk where I kind of work with my hands and make things. I really lose time in a fantastic way there. In a sense that you can lose time scrolling through Instagram. You can do the same when you're consumed with something, when you're creative. And I mean, a couple of hours can pass and I have no idea where that time has gone, but you know, I feel very good afterwards. Whereas if I've spent a little bit too long scrolling or going off in tangents on Google searches, whatever, I really don't feel great afterwards. And that's, if I have to just say what's good for you and what's not good for you, you kind of always know inside. You don't have someone to tell you should have spent this long doing this, or you shouldn't be on social media this long. You just kind of know, because you feel rubbish. Yeah, I don't mind wasting time on my desk, where days when I play around on my desk where I really don't make anything that I like. But even then, there's always something I can salvage. There'll be something that will be some little mark I've made or some little idea I've had that will be worth taking to the next day. And then it's worth it. But it's never wasted time, that kind of work, ever.
Well, coming to the end now, you'll be relieved. You can go to sleep after this. I just, there's One little thing that interests me and I'd like your view on is that I seem to hear the word collaboration whenever I read a design article these days or hear a designer talking. And it would seem that the individual creative is being kind of marginalized these days. But I think the illustrator, i.e. your world, is pretty safe on that front because they have a direct channel from their brain to whatever is coming out at the other end from their hand on the page. And so I think although you might create by because a client says, could you do an illustration for this topic? Nevertheless, you're still very much on your own and doing your own thing. Whereas many designers in the world of graphics are all working together and you end up with 10,000 people who've been responsible for doing this thing. Okay, on complex digital things, I can understand it. But for one single thing, I don't know, I don't get it.
I mean, I think collaboration is always great. I think it's always been hard for illustrators to collaborate because the imagery is like just this one language that's coming out of you, your body into another language. And it's very hard to, whenever I've tried to work with people, even to help me do stuff, it hasn't worked that well because I don't really know what I'm doing a lot of the time. So it's very hard for me to explain to someone how to help me. And it's a bit like writing a novel. I don't think novelists necessarily collaborate, do they?
I think they show their work to various friends and editors who might give them some pointers about, you know, sentences are too complex or whatever.
It's the only thing I can think that's similar, because if you're a songwriter, you could collaborate and you could probably get something better. But there's something about the way image makers have to make their image. And I still love the idea of collaborating. And I think you could collaborate in a different way, but getting that kind of that imagery out of your head onto paper or whatever form it goes into, I think is a kind of singular pursuit, actually. You can change, whenever I've worked in books, those are collaborative projects in a sense, you know, there's a lot of people involved, and but the actual stuff that you make comes from one.
They may make comments on, we don't think that this quite works, but you're still left on your own. Anyway, we come to the end now. I always end up these interviews with the same question, which is really about those graduating students, and in your case it would be illustration students who, you know, let's face it, have had a horrible time by not having those lovely experiences that we've talked about earlier, meeting all those like-minded people, because they've been stuck at home looking at screens, which is a tragedy really, and they're hoping that somehow they'll be able to follow in the footsteps of people like you. Do you have any...
I've said this to my own kids or teenagers, is this experience we've all had, you have to turn it around to make it into a positive experience, because you could go through the rest of your life saying I didn't do this because of, or I didn't manage to, you know, I failed, I missed my opportunity because of COVID. And I remember going to Cuba and met a lot of artists who had no money, had no materials, were really struggling, couldn't leave the country, you know, had very, very strict parameters on what they could do. And yet they were the most creative bunch of people I'd met in many, many years. And they made work about their situation. And I do remember feeling quite envious, thinking they've really got this fantastic, got a difficult time and they're channeling it into their work. And I don't have that struggle. Everything's quite easy in a sense. And they had this amazing resource to tap into, to make artwork about. It. And that's what art's brilliant for, isn't it? It's brilliant for kind of being able to explain really difficult circumstances. And so I think, I'm hoping that we will see a creative explosion because of COVID, actually. And the students should tap into that, because it's something they can, they've had an experience that's quite unique. And they should be able to turn that into something that they can learn from and actually be inspired by. That's what I would say.
Well, I think that's very sound advice. Marion Duchard, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insight.
Thank you very much for chatting. Very nice.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, there are over 50 more featuring royal designers from a wide range of disciplines talking about their life and work. Just type RDI Insights-RSA into your browser and you'll find them.